about the accuracy and reliability of the Bible. And you see, when I talk about we're cutting the threads of the past, we're also going to have to make some adjustments. We're going to have to realize that we're facing new challenges. As we deal with the world now, as we deal with people now, it is not simply a matter of comparing some religious notes about, well, what do you do? Well, what do you believe in doing when you worship God? Well, what do you believe about salvation? Those things still must be dealt with. But we're also facing a time when we are going to need to be assured ourselves about the accuracy and reliability of our Bible text. And we're also going to have to be able to help others to be able to deal with that. We're going to have to be able to teach them. So, I'm going to make a few preliminary remarks and then we'll get into the study. So, the value of a study like this is for several different reasons. One is it's an interesting study. It's an interesting story in certain aspects of the study of this subject. They read like a detective novel. They read like an adventure novel. It's just fascinating information. But the most important reason for studying this subject is to see that the evidence proves that we have a reliable copy of the Scriptures. It is widely claimed that there is no way to know whether we have accurate copies of the original documents of the Bible. Now, this is claimed all about. It's claimed by unbelievers. Many casual unbelievers write the Bible off by saying, oh, there's no way to know if we have an accurate translation. And that just means, so I don't have to pay any attention to that. I don't have to worry about this. This is a subject that need not occupy my mind. One would think that the Bible is a book someone found just yesterday and that there's no record of its transmission at all. And nothing could be farther from the truth than that. In this lesson, we will look at some facts about the Bible, about its origin and its transmission. There will be differences in how you will use this information. In other words, I know that I have people of all sorts of different levels and walks of life. Some of you may find this information difficult. I hope not. I hope that the way I am presenting it will make it so it will not be difficult. But I want to make some suggestions to help all of you use the information I'm going to present. First of all, there's a lot of information in the lesson you may not have heard much about. We cannot accomplish all goals at once. In other words, in this lesson, I know that I'm not going suddenly to be able to make all of us experts in textual criticism. That is not my desire, whatever. I want to equip us to deal with those who question the accuracy of the Bible. But it takes a lot of study to be comfortable in handling this material. And yet that is a goal that I really have in this lesson. I want to equip us to be able to deal with those who question the accuracy of the Bible. But I realize that it is a challenge to get really well-versed in the information. So the first goal that I have is to satisfy those of you here today that the text of the Bible has been accurately transmitted throughout the centuries. That's my first goal. So, even if you cannot turn around and quote these facts or use these facts to convince someone else, you can say that you have heard the evidence. You can say, I have heard the evidence. And I want you to understand that I'm not concerned that you won't be able to walk out of here and name all the manuscripts and name all... That's not the point here. The point is you will be able to say, I have seen the evidence myself, you have heard the evidence, and you are convinced that we have a reliable and accurate copy of the original writings of the inspired men. Now, on the other hand, for others of you, and especially, I want you young people who are either in college or you're about to go off to college, you're about to go home, go away from home, you're going to find yourselves the young adults who are going to face the bulk of this century. And you know, you don't really think about that. You guys are going to be adults, and your life, if it be a long life, it will take up hopefully a great deal of this century we have just entered into. I think about things like my dad was born pretty well at the beginning of the last century. And in a way, some of you, you know, I just think about, you know, my grandmother was born in 1897. And so I think, wow, was she? Oh, wow, boy. Well, you think of when you were born. And then you think of 100 years from now. People are going to say, boy, were you old? You'll have to get used to it. It takes some getting used to. But then we also have a lot of young adults already with families who are very active in work, in life. You have lots of contacts with different people. Now, this is not going to be beyond you at all. And you need to pay careful attention to this. And I hope that this lesson for you will be the start of a study that will eventually enable you to use this information to convince the unbeliever and the inquiring student that the Bible is an accurate copy of the original writings of inspired men. Now, I realize there are people who are so bent on disbelieving God's Word that evidence is not going to mean anything at all to them. I can't do anything about that, and you cannot do it either. But there are a lot of people who are honestly ignorant about this. They don't know the facts. And my hope is that I can equip us to be able to put those facts into their hands and help them to understand this point. All right, so let's start now by looking at the original writings of the inspired men. Now then, understand what I'm saying. I'm talking about the actual writings of Moses. I'm talking about the actual writings of Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, of Paul. The very writing that they themselves did. These original writings are referred to as autographs. The word auto means self, and graph means writing. Therefore, they're called autographs, meaning the works originally written or dictated by the authors of the Bible themselves. None of these has ever been found. We have never found an autograph of anyone who wrote in the Bible. But this should not be disturbing to us, because as we shall show, no originals of hardly any truly ancient document have been found. Whether it is the Bible, or Tacitus, or Homer, in other words, those ancient documents, almost none of them have we ever found the original copy. So this is no problem. This is common. And with regard to the Bible, it must be remembered that its oldest writings would go back 3,500 years ago. Now you ponder for a moment, what would last for 3,500 years? What would it take to last so far as a substance is concerned? The primary sources of writing that reaches that far back are inscriptions in stone or in clay tablets that are baked hard or on pieces of pottery called potsherds or ostraca. In other words, in that day when people had a clay pottery vessel that was broken, instead of just throwing all the pieces away, they would keep those pieces. And it's interesting, even in the Bible, you can read that one of the things they'd use a piece for would be to pick up a hot coal with it. If it was curved enough, you could even get a drink of water in it. Just the scooped shape of the piece. But another thing that they used those broken pieces of pottery for was Post-its. You see, now, of course, they wouldn't stick on anything. But you see, you and I have to realize they couldn't go down to Walmart's and buy a 6 or 12 or 18 or 35 or 156 pack of Post-its or yellow legal pads. And no, they didn't have all that stuff. You just did not walk out and grab that. So they used whatever was handy. And a lot of times that was the pottery vessel that was broken last week. We'll keep the pieces around and use them for who knows what. Some of the pieces weren't big enough to do anything with, and some of the prophets make the point that Israel is going to be broken into enough pieces that it won't be there won't be a piece big enough to do anything with. And see, they were talking about this very idea here. Most of the Bible books were written through the years on either paper or animal hides. And the most common and the most durable by far was animal hides. They'd take the hide and they would cure the hide, tan it, prepare it. They would put chalk on it. They would cut it square. And some of the surfaces were very beautiful. And these were called vellum or parchment. And are you familiar with the word parchment? The word parchment is just sort of a garbled version of Pergamum. Because Pergamum, that is, you know, one of the seven churches of Revelation 1, 2, and 3. Pergamum was famous for making this product. And therefore, the name of the city came to be attached with the name of the substance that was written upon. This was vellum or parchment. And so you can see that even though it was an animal hide, that'd be more durable than paper, still, for something like that to be around 3,500 years later is asking a little bit much. And so we don't have any of the originals. At least none have ever been found. So these documents that were written on vellum, animal hide, or on paper, they tended to perish. And in the case of the Jews, now this is a very fascinating thing to learn about the Jews. The Jews so revered even the substance upon which the Scriptures were written that when one was getting badly warned, they either put it aside in a special storehouse or closet, or they would destroy it to keep it from being subjected to some profane use. They could not abide the idea that you might put a sheet down on a counter and use it to cut your meat up on, and other uses that it might be put to. So they would destroy it to keep that from happening. So the first thing that we've looked at here is we've seen we don't have any of the original manuscripts written by the authors themselves. And that a lot of that is because they were written on perishable things and therefore were not preserved. There may be other reasons that we don't know about. But anyway, we do not have. So what do we have? We have a lot, and it's going to take me a while to tell you what we have. But see, you need to know this, because when people say, oh, you just can't know whether we have an accurate copy or not, they are either deliberately trying to deceive you and lie about it, or they are totally ignorant of the subject. It's one or the other. In view of the difficulties connected with the preservation of ancient writings, it is amazing how many manuscripts have survived. So, let's take a minute and collect all the sources of information that we have of and about the Bible. First, there are copies, I say copies, of the originals in both Hebrew and Greek. So that the Old Testament, we have copies of it in Hebrew, and we have copies of the New Testament in Greek. Secondly, there are translations. Translations, yes. I mean ancient translations. The Septuagint translation of the Hebrew Scriptures, translated some maybe 280 B.C. to 100 B.C., well over 100 years before Christ, this translation was made of the Hebrew Scriptures. So, you see, right there, even if we didn't go any further, we could say, you know, what this means is I can take my Old Testament right here that I look at in the pages of my Bible, and I can compare that with the Septuagint translation of the Scriptures made over 2,000 years ago. So, it's not as if I don't have anything to compare it to so that I can see whether it's accurate or not. I have the Septuagint version translated over 2,000 years ago that I can compare it with. There are Aramaic translations. There are Latin translations. There are Coptic translations. Coptic is a language of Egypt that showed up in the late New Testament age and after that. But that's not all. Copies of the originals, translations of the originals. We even have commentaries. Commentaries, these are commonly called targums. And a targum means the idea of a translation, but it was a translation with notes, explanatory notes and paraphrases. We have these available, and some of these are quite old. There are lectionaries. Now, a lectionary is simply a piece of paper or animal hide or whatever you'd write it on. And passages were copied onto these to be used for reading in public worship. Now, that's what they are. So, at some worship service in some congregation, somebody wrote these verses and these passages out for this to be used in the worship. That's what these are. With regard to the New Testament Scriptures, not the Old Testament, with regard to the New Testament Scriptures, there are also the extensive writings of the Church Fathers. Now again, all I'm doing is showing you this is what we've got pulled together so that we can examine these things and compare these things with what we have today and say, do we have an accurate copy? So already I hope that you're seeing that it's not that we don't have anything to go on. But now these writings of the Church Fathers are very, very impressive. These men, and especially the ones that lived in the age between 100 A.D. and 325 A.D., in this period, these men wrote letters to individuals and to churches. And when they would write, they would quote Scripture voluminously. And they would write out very extensive passages. They wrote essays to government officials in which they explained Christianity and they defended Christianity. Sometimes they conducted written debates with various opponents, and in those they would quote a great deal of Scripture. One can almost reconstruct the New Testament from the writings of these men alone. Don't read this yet. Let me tell you one more thing. If we were to take all the writings of the Church Fathers and go through them and hunt out the Scriptures and put those Scriptures together, we would find that when we got through, we would have assembled almost the entire New Testament. In fact, from one of these men alone, I may mention him later, from one of these Church Fathers alone, his name is Origen, it has been estimated that 3/4 of the New Testament can be found in his writings alone. So that means that I can take the New Testament that I have and I can compare it with the writings of Origen, and that takes me almost back to the time of the originals. There's a great student of the Bible that was lived a few decades ago. His name was J. Early Arsenault. So most of you probably would not have heard of him. But he was a very fine student, and he wrote an article on this subject one time. It was very impressive to me. And he told me about how in Great Britain there was I want everybody to realize that sometimes my marbles almost get lost. And so you have to just give me a minute to get things going here. In this article by J. Early Arsenault, he told about a meeting that was held of a literary club in England. And in this literary club, they got to talking about this, whether the Bible could be put together from the writings of the Church Fathers and so on. So there was one man in the midst who decided he'd take a try at it. So some time went by, and a friend came by to his house, and there were books scattered all over everywhere. And so he said, "What's going on? What have you done?" He said, "Well, you know, I got interested in that matter, and so I got all my sources of the Church Fathers and spread them out here and started looking these things up. And I have found every verse but 11 verses so far." That was pretty impressive. I haven't quoted that particular story as evidence because I don't know for sure whether that story is true. But I do know that the writings of the church fathers are such that we can almost recreate the New Testament from their writings. So let's look at this conclusion here. What we see today when we take a Bible into our hands to read is the fruit of an unimaginable amount of work by more men than can be counted, reaching back over 3,500 years to the very first words of the Bible written by Moses. In other words, it's an unimaginable amount of work done by more men than we know of. And yet all of this work has gone into the fact that we have a Bible today that is accurate, and it has not been corrupted, and we're going to be able to see that more and more as time goes along. Now, there is no way to know about all of this work. What we know probably is only the hem of the garment of the work that has been done by many people that history will never know about. And even a lifetime would not suffice to read and digest all of the work that has been done through the centuries to preserve the Bible. So I want you to just understand that when you hold that Bible in your hand, we tend to just take for granted that, I bought it at so-and-so. I just want you to understand that the blessing of God is not that you can merely go to a store and buy one. The blessing of God is that in His providence, all of this tremendous mountain of work has been done by more people than we can possibly know. And all of it has been done in order that we might have a copy of the Scriptures today. So even though we can't study all or know all of the information, we can study the high points of the information and gain great confidence in the reliability of the Bible. So how can we be assured that the books of the Bible have been accurately copied and passed down over the 2,000 years and more since they were written? How can we know that? When I talked about what we have, I mentioned the things like the copies of the manuscripts, the translations, the commentaries, the lectionaries, the writings of the church fathers, all of those things. How can we be assured? Well, it basically boils down to this. We can take what we have and we can compare it with what existed in the very long ago past, and we can see that corruption that's supposed to have crept in there, it has not. It has not crept. It has not crept into the transmission of the Bible. Now then, I want us to take some time here in answering this question. How can we be assured that the books of the Bible have been accurately copied and passed down over the 2,000 years and more since they were written? Seems like a very big question. It seems like a question that you could almost think, I don't know if I'm going to look at that question or not. Why, it's almost scary to look at that question. What I'm telling you is there's nothing scary about it. The evidence is so overwhelming that you shouldn't be afraid of this question at all. Today, translations abound. I think we all realize that. Some of these translations today are excellent. Some are good only for certain purposes. Some are good merely for comparison. And some are completely unacceptable. Some translations are translations in name only, being really distortions and adaptations to make the Bible fit somebody's doctrinal system, such as the New World Translation by the Jehovah's Witnesses. That is probably the worst translation that exists. The version that is the most famous is the King James Version, published in 1611. Now, everybody... Probably, I can assume that everybody has heard of the King James Version, can I not? Later translations, such as the American Standard Version, the English Standard Version, and others, have all made use of the King James Version. Now, that doesn't mean that they're just totally based on it. A reading will show you that that's not the case. But if you'll read in most of the prefaces and introductions to whatever version you may have, Almost certainly somewhere in that introduction, it will be pointed out that reference was made to the King James Version. So I'm just saying that the King James Version, even though a lot of people don't use it anymore, that even in the many later translations that have been made, the King James Version still figures pretty strongly as a reference for that. And in the case of most of these, the reason for a new translation was to update the archaic language of the King James Version. Now, you realize that King James Version would have been translated back in the Elizabethan era, in the era of Shakespeare. And most of us have had that inestimable joy somewhere in the 11th or 12th grade of studying Shakespeare. And that's too early to study Shakespeare. You should wait until later when you can really appreciate it. At that age, we're tending to say, well, what do they talk funny for? Not realizing that, well, they talk funny because that was the way they talked back then, and to them it wasn't funny. But if you have read Shakespeare, you know that it's kind of hard to understand what the language is. It's hard to understand the language. That's because, do you realize we're coming up on 400 years ago? Do you realize that? We're coming up on 400 years ago. The 400th anniversary of the translation of the King James Version. But even more importantly, these later translations were made to incorporate the wealth of manuscripts that have been found since 1611 into the translation. I want us to start. We're going to take a little journey. We're going to take a little journey back. And we're going to start with the American Standard Version. Now, that's the one that I use mostly. I don't know how many of you may use it. I know my daughter uses it at least a good bit. But let's start with it. And we're going to go back and see some things. The American Standard Version was translated in 1901. Actually, the New Testament was done in 1881 and revised by the American Committee in 1900. And when I first started out reading, I was thinking, well, that wasn't very long ago. Now, at this point, as I tell you, I can't say that anymore. It is a long time ago, a whole century ago. The Old Testament was done from 1881 to 1885 and newly edited in 1901. So we can still say around 1900. Now, there would be no skeptic on earth who would say the Bible is no older than the American Standard Version. It just started right there. There's no skeptic that would say that. They know better than to say that. They wouldn't say that. So that means that the American Standard Version is based on something earlier. You see, we still have copies of this version. See, here is my copy of this. I can read this and I can say, okay, so this is one that was done in 1901, and it was set up to be printed and has been printed ever since. So here in 2003, at the close of 2003, I can read a book whose history reaches back 100 years. And there haven't been any corruptions that have made their way into it in the last 100 years. Okay? So, we've gone back that far now. Going back 300 years from that translation, you know, from 1900 back to 1600, we go back 300 years from that translation, we come to the King James, or Authorized Version, as it was called. And this Bible is still widespread. Now, that means that we still have all over the place Bibles that were translated in 1611. And we can read them, and we even have original copies of the King James Version that go back to the 1600s when the book was printed. Well, did the corruptions come in those 300 years? No. No, no corruptions in there. The King James Version was based to a great extent on the translation of William Tyndale, which had been printed in 1525. Now, all I want you to do here, I don't want you to remember the date. I don't want you to remember William Tyndale. I'd like for some of you to be able to do it eventually. But what I'm wanting you to see is, isn't 1525 earlier than 1611? Well, we can go back that nearly 100 years, and guess what? No corruptions. But that's not all that we can do. The Tyndale's New Testament was based on a Greek text put together by a scholar of the Reformation period by the name of Erasmus, and that was in 1516. You see, they didn't have a New Testament in Greek to study from. They just had this manuscript and that manuscript and that manuscript. They didn't have a complete Greek New Testament that they could work from at this point. So Erasmus was a Reformation scholar, and he said, you know, I really wish we did have that. And he was pretty much a scholar himself, quite a scholar. So he decided that he would put together a Greek text, but he was severely limited in the manuscripts he had to work with. According to Ira Morris Price, who wrote a book called The Ancestry of the English Bible, Erasmus had 6 manuscripts. That's amazing. He had 6. And those 6, he got most of it from them, but they were missing some parts. These manuscripts were not complete, not even having the end of Revelation among them. So that what Erasmus had to do was, he had to take the Latin Vulgate, which at that time had been around for about 1,100 years or so, and he had to take the Latin and kind of guess what the Greek would have been. And he had to translate Latin back into the Greek for that little bit there at the end of Revelation, because he didn't have Revelation in those manuscripts that were available to him. And so he took the Latin Vulgate and attempted to translate it back into the Greek, and it would have been an educated guess at best. Well, the thing is, an enormous amount of manuscripts have been discovered since 1611 and certainly since 1516. An enormous number of manuscripts. And some of them are the earliest and the best that exist that have been found. Now, what do you think these would show? Corruption, corruption, corruption. No, surprisingly, hardly any corruption at all. Now, we're going to close this morning in just a moment. But I want you to think about this. These manuscripts. Now, here's something you need to understand. There's a lot of talk about families of manuscripts. Families just has reference to manuscripts that share certain qualities, certain similarities that the manuscripts have. And the scholars that study them say, okay, these all bear these characteristics. They go in this family. Here are some that bear these characteristics. They go in this family. So the two major families that those manuscripts are grouped into are called the Byzantine and the Alexandrian. That is two cities of the ancient world. One, Constantinople or Byzantium, modern-day Istanbul. And the other was the Alexandrian, which was Alexandria, Egypt. These are the two major families. The Byzantine family is the one that lies largely behind the King James Version, and the Alexandrian that which largely lies behind the American Standard Version. And one thing you have to remember when you read or hear textual critics talking, their job is to make molehills into mountains. Because they talk about the differences between the Byzantine family and the Alexandrian family as, oh, such enormous differences. Though to the student of textual criticism, the differences between these two families are significant, to the common student of the Bible, they're not great at all. And to illustrate this, you can take the King James Version and compare it with the American Standard Version, and that's about what the difference is. It will be readily apparent that the differences between these two families are not crucial to faith. They're not crucial to understanding. These differences do not affect that at all. Okay, now at this point, we're going to stop. And tonight, I want to continue taking us back and showing us that it's not that we don't have anything to compare what we're looking at today with. We have a wonderful record of transmission all the way back. So the fact is, there is no way that all this corruption could have been brought in. I also realize that in a lesson such as we're having today, we are not actually approaching the subject of how are you to be saved. Nor have we approached the subject of how can you be a better husband, a better wife, and so on. But I am utterly convinced that we must have lessons like this as well. Because we not only have to be able to teach what the Bible says, we have to be able to defend the Bible itself as a book that has integrity. We are going to have to be able to do that. And therefore, I am completely convinced that we have to have lessons like this occasionally.